content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the first new edition of the new year, dated January 17th, 2014. We start with the main stories and how they were covered. The White House's long game on Obamacare. What happened? After a last-minute enrollment spike, the Obama administration announced that it had signed up 2.1 million people in private health plans and 4.4 million in Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act by the January 1st deadline for coverage to begin with the new year. With the healthcare.gov web portal now operating effectively for most users, the White House began pressing its campaign to enroll millions more by the March 31st deadline to have health coverage in 2014 or pay a penalty. "We're focused on the long game for March 31st, one White House official told Politico.com. Massachusetts' experience in launching its similar RomneyCare health reform in 2006, the official said, shows that people come in at the end. Republican critics noted that the administration had fallen short of its original goal of enrolling 3.3 million in private plans by January 1st and was a long way off from the target of 7 million Americans enrolled by March 31st. The administration distanced itself from the 7 million figure, saying that number originated with the Congressional Budget Office, not the White House. What the editorial said: after an abysmal start caused by an incompetent rollout and resistance from Republican politicians, the ACA is finally on track, said the Washington Post. Millions of people who lacked insurance are now telling stories of finally seeing doctors for everything from precancerous moles to diabetes to gallbladder surgery. But to work well, the private insurers on the exchanges need to sign up millions more enrollees, especially healthy people under 30. It's simply too early to tell whether those people will enroll. Obamacare supporters shouldn't be celebrating, said the Orange County, California Register. About 4.7 million Americans had their old plans canceled, and while it's not clear how many got to keep them under revised rules or switched to other plans, Obamacare has so far produced many losers as well as winners. Another group that will have a hard pill to swallow are healthier middle-class Americans who don't qualify for subsidies under the ACA and have to pay higher premiums to provide affordable plans to the older and sicker. What the columnist said: with millions protected by its provisions, Obamacare is now here to stay, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. So the Republicans' gleeful predictions of imminent collapse will now give way to indignant attacks on the nefarious tactics used to make the law work. Remember the prediction of a death spiral of soaring premiums if enough young people don't sign up? Conservatives just realized that the ACA has a provision that will keep that from happening. $20 billion collected from a tax on insurers and employers that can be used to offset any insurance company losses for 3 years. The result? No death spiral and more sputtering Republican rage. Obamacare will be a failure despite these tricks, said Grace Marie Turner in NationalReview.com. Enrollment numbers will likely remain low because the plans are too costly for self-insuring members of the middle class. Faced with paying premiums of $3,000 or more a year and carrying a $4,000 annual deductible, Millions just won't see the value in buying coverage. Opposition to the bill will also grow as its least popular provisions go into effect, said Lenny Chin in Bloomberg.com. In order to cut costs while meeting Obamacare's mandates, insurers are strictly limiting coverage to small groups of doctors and hospitals. At this year's midterms, Democrats will pay the price for Obama's misguided effort to remake the American healthcare system. That makeover has just begun, said Noam Schieber in NewRepublic.com. By complaining about insurance costs, deductibles, and limits on networks, Republicans are playing into the trap Obamacare laid for them. The ACA has begun creating a broad constituency for government-subsidized health insurance, and when people complain about its shortcomings, they'll be demanding more coverage at lower prices. Over time, public pressure will force Washington to ramp up its role in the health care sector, as we inevitably evolve toward what liberal Democrats have always wanted, a single-payer health system. Our second main story, Al-Qaeda's resurgence in Iraq. The Iraqi government was engaged this week in a ferocious battle with Al-Qaeda-affiliated militants who have captured the strategic cities of Fallujah and Ramadi in the western province of Anbar, raising the prospect of all-out civil war. The province, where almost a third of the 4,400 U.S. fatalities occurred in some of the Iraq War's bloodiest fighting, has been overrun in recent weeks by fighters from the Al-Qaeda-linked Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS. As government forces surrounded and shelled Fallujah and carried out airstrikes on insurgent-held areas, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki appealed to regional Sunni tribes and residents to expel the terrorists. The U.S. this week stepped up shipments of drones and Hellfire missiles to the Iraqi military, amid fears that ISIS now controls a 400-mile swath across western Iraq and the north of neighboring Syria. But Secretary of State John Kerry made clear that no American troops would be sent in to help al-Maliki's government. "This is their fight," said Kerry, "but we're going to help them in their fight." After the 2009 surge, Iraq and the U.S. had the rare chance to create a stable country, said Max Boot in WSJ.com. "This opportunity has been squandered. The main culprits are al-Maliki and his predatory sectarian Shiite government, which victimized Sunnis from the moment U.S. forces departed. President Obama is at fault, too, for having foolishly pulled out our troops before Iraq could stand on its own." "You can't blame Obama," said Jeffrey Goldberg in Bloomberg.com. "The U.S. did not create the problems that plague the Arab Middle East, which is now clearly enmeshed in a radical civil war between Sunnis and Shiites. Nor is America equipped to inject itself successfully into these complicated and hate-filled sectarian struggles. Regardless of the blame, the terrorists have benefited massively from the chaos," said Peter Bergen in CNN.com. "Indeed, Al-Qaeda appears to control more territory in the Arab world than it has done at any time in its history." "It's unsurprising, then," said the Boston Globe in an editorial, "that military families across America look at Iraq and ask, why did my child, my spouse, have to die in the effort, only to have it all unravel?" The controversy of the week. Snowden. Does he deserve a pardon? When someone reveals that government officials have routinely and deliberately broken the law, said the New York Times in an editorial, that person should not face life in prison at the hands of the same government. Such, however, is the fate awaiting Edward Snowden, the former government contractor who last year told the world about the shocking depth and breadth of the National Security Agency's surveillance programs. Without Snowden, we'd never have known that the NSA was keeping records of every phone call made in the U.S. and abroad, or that it had tunneled into major internet data centers and the servers of Facebook, Google, and other private companies, or that National Intelligence Director James Clapper lied to Congress when he denied any systematic surveillance of U.S. citizens. Snowden is clearly a whistleblower, not a spy. Yet he faces espionage charges should he ever return to the U.S. from Moscow, where he has temporary asylum. "This isn't a complicated issue," said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com. "Either you believe we'd be better off never knowing about NSA surveillance programs, one federal judge has called almost Orwellian, or you have to approve of what Snowden did, warts and all, and should support a plea bargain deal or a presidential pardon. Given the public outrage at the extent of NSA surveillance, I'd say the choice is obvious." Edward Snowden is no hero, said NationalReview.com. Only a tiny portion of the NSA abuses he revealed were illegal, and those had already been caught and corrected by internal audits and the Federal Surveillance Court. If he felt a need to blow a whistle on some specific practices, he should have contacted the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. Instead, he perpetrated the gravest intelligence breach in U.S. history, stealing as many as 1.1 million documents and defecting to China and Russia. A pardon for Snowden would set a dangerous precedent, said Josh Barrow in BusinessInsider.com, effectively telling government workers to use their own judgment in deciding what to keep classified. "I trust the government to decide what needs to be secret more than I trust rogue contractors with security clearances." If Snowden had released only information about the NSA's domestic surveillance, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com, then some form of leniency might be worth discussing. But he went far beyond the role of a patriotic whistleblower. Snowden released classified documents about the surveillance of Taliban fighters in Pakistan, as well as targets inside Iran, showed al-Qaeda how the NSA uses phone records to map terrorist networks, and revealed that the NSA regularly hacks computers in China, America's sworn cyber enemy. Then this self-declared champion of individual liberty and government transparency sought refuge in authoritarian China and Vladimir Putin's Russia. Has this proven liar shared U.S. intelligence secrets with these hostile regimes? Who knows? But look at the bigger picture, said Jonathan Turley in the Los Angeles Times. President Obama chose not to prosecute the CIA employees or Bush administration officials who tortured or ordered the torture of suspected terrorists on the grounds that these officials believed they were doing their patriotic duty when they committed crimes. The same can be said of Snowden, who has undeniably triggered a critical debate over security and privacy in this country. A presidential pardon would be a welcome signal that wherever we ultimately decide to strike that balance, the White House is serious about reform and accepts responsibility for the abuses that have been documented. On the briefing page, we have Japan's population crisis. Japan's birth rate is plummeting. Why have so many young Japanese given up on getting married? Why is Japan in trouble? The Japanese now have one of the lowest fertility rates in the world, and at the same time, one of the highest longevity rates. As a result, the population is dropping rapidly and becoming increasingly weighted toward older people. After peaking 7 years ago at 128 million, Japan's population has been falling and is on a path to decline by about 1 million people a year. By 2060, the government estimates, there will be just 87 million people in Japan. Nearly half of them will be over 65. Without a dramatic change in either the birth rate or its restrictive immigration policies, Japan simply won't have enough workers to support its retirees and will enter a demographic death spiral. Yet the babies aren't coming. Why not? The British newspaper The Observer recently caused an international stir by reporting that Japanese youth have lost interest in sex. The sensationalist conclusion was mostly based on a single statistic, a survey that found that 45% of women and 25% of men ages 16 to 24 said they were not looking to have sex. The article also cited the phrase Sekusu Shinai Shokugun, or celibacy syndrome, as if it were a major trend. In reality, more Japanese singles are having sex than in past decades. In 1990, 65% of unmarried women and 45% of unmarried men had never had sex. Today, the figures are 50% and 40% respectively. Of course, Japanese have sex, Asian studies professor Jeff Kingston told Bloomberg.com. If the number of love hotels is any barometer, it seems like many are getting plenty of it. Is celibacy syndrome a myth? Not entirely. There clearly is a subset of Japanese youth who have withdrawn from dating. Instead, they focus on online porn and games like Nintendo's Love Plus, in which players conduct a relationship with an anime girlfriend. Hundreds of thousands of young men are known as hikikomori, shut-ins who eschew human contact and spend their days playing video games and reading comics in their parents' homes. But most Japanese young people do have friends and relationships. They're just not settling down. The marriage rate has plummeted, and with it the birth rate, since out-of-wedlock births are rare in Japan. In 1975, just 21% of women and 49% of men under 30 had never been married. By 2005, the figures were 60% of women and 72% of men. Why aren't they getting married? There are both cultural and economic barriers. In Japanese tradition, marriage was more about duty than romantic love. Arranged marriages were the norm well into the 1970s, and even into the 1990s, most marriages were facilitated by go-betweens, often the groom's bosses. Left to their own devices, Japanese men aren't sure how to find wives, and many are shying away from the hunt because they simply can't afford it. Wages have stagnated since the 1990s, while housing prices have shot up. A young Japanese man has good reason to believe that his standard of living would drop immensely if he had to house and support a wife and children, especially considering that his wife likely wouldn't be working. Why make that assumption? In Japan, marriage usually ends a woman's working career, even though most women are well-educated. Once they have a child, women face strong social pressure to quit their jobs and assume very traditional roles, serving both the husband and the child. Mothers who want to keep working are stigmatized and usually find that employers won't hire them. Childcare is scarce and expensive, while Japan's brutal work culture often demands that employees work more than 50 hours a week. Japanese husbands aren't much help either. They spend an average of 1 hour a day helping with the children and household chores, compared with 3 hours for husbands in the U.S. and Western Europe. You end up being a housewife with no independent income, bank worker Eri Tomita told The Observer. It's not an option for women like me. Could this tradition change? Prime Minister Shinzo Abe wants it to. This fall, he renamed his economic plan from Abenomics to Womenomics, creating an environment in which women find it comfortable to work. He told the UN General Assembly, is no longer a matter of choice for Japan. It is instead a matter of the greatest urgency. He promised to expand daycare offerings and promote flexible work arrangements so that women would no longer have to choose between work and childbearing. And he challenged businesses to promote women to senior management. Most economists, though, think that the trends won't change fast enough to prevent a real demographic crisis. Sooner or later, said economics professor Heizo Takanaka, Japan will have to face the necessity of immigration. Take a look now at the best columns from the U.S. The first from Charles M. Blow at the New York Times. The GOP's War on Evolution. The debate over evolution was settled a century ago, but not for Republicans, said Charles M. Blow. A new Pew poll has found an 11% decline since 2009 in Republicans who believe our species evolved over time, with 48% now insisting that God created humans just as they are today. This isn't only sad, it's embarrassing. Why, with most Americans now accepting the overwhelming evidence of evolution, would more Republicans be retreating into a 19th century worldview? It's the result of a prolonged ploy by Republican leaders and culture warriors such as Fox News to play on the most base convictions of conservative voters. In this cynical crusade against secular culture and science, passion and devotion are weapons against doubt and confusion. So climate change, the Big Bang, and evolution must be categorically rejected as threats to religious faith, which they're not. This tactic has succeeded in keeping the Republican rank and file riled up, at the cost of keeping them and our nation trapped in deliberate ignorance. The second column is from Heather McDonald, The Wall Street Journal. Getting a degree in victimhood. To a major in English at a fine university, you'd think you'd need to know something of Chaucer, Shakespeare, and Milton, said Heather McDonald. But not anymore. After a revolt by young faculty members, the prestigious English department at the University of California, Los Angeles, has dumped requirements that majors study the work of these dead white males in favor of courses in gender, race, ethnicity, and disability and sexuality studies. It's a widespread trend in the study of the humanities, an obsession with victimhood, and a relentless determination to reduce the stunning complexity of the past to the shallow categories of identity and class politics. A humanities education once gave students a tour through the finest knowledge, philosophical thought, and artistry of Western civilization. But many postmodern academics and students view all that as a dated legacy of the empire. So the humanities are now the study of oppression in all forms, of women, of people of color, of people of different sexual orientations. Plato, Shakespeare, Mozart, just three more oppressive white males. No wonder interest in the humanities is in steep decline. And finally, from Amy Parker at Slate.com, when kids aren't vaccinated. As the child of a 1970s health nut, I grew up unvaccinated, said Amy Parker. I ate a relentlessly healthy diet of organic vegetables, took vitamins and echinacea, and yet I was sick all the time. Left undefended because of my parents' fear of unnatural vaccines, I contracted measles, mumps, rubella, a type of viral meningitis, scarlatina, whooping cough, yearly tonsillitis, and chickenpox. These illnesses were not, as some anti-vaxxers would tell you, brief, temporary inconveniences. They were truly miserable ordeals, which included the inability to breathe or to eat or to swallow, fever and nightmares, itching all over your body so much that you can't stand lying on bed sheets, and prolonged diarrhea and vomiting. Some people even lose their sight, hearing, or lives to rubella, measles, and other now preventable diseases. When I became a mother, I didn't hesitate in having my two children vaccinated, despite the false scaremongering by anti-vaxxers. My kids have rarely been ill and are growing up healthier than I have ever been. If parents don't stop succumbing to irrational fears, childhood illnesses we've virtually eradicated will come roaring back. Children will pay a terrible price for our foolishness. We'll take a look at one of the obituaries this week. The harmonizer who inspired the Beatles. Phil Everly, 1939 to 2014. Together with his older brother, Don, Phil Everly helped draw the blueprint of rock and roll in the 1950s and early 60s. The Everly brothers' exquisite harmonies on tracks like Bye Bye Love and Wake Up Little Susie would inspire acts from the Beatles to Simon and Garfunkel, even though harmony was often absent from the brothers' personal relationship. They fought offstage and on, and famously called it quits after Phil smashed his guitar and walked off during a gig in 1973. Yet their sense of brotherhood was never lost. "We're closer than most brothers," Phil said in 1986. "Harmony is the ultimate love." Philip was born the son of a Kentucky coal miner turned musician, Ike Everly, and his wife Margaret. The family had left Kentucky for Chicago to pursue musical opportunities, said the New York Times, and moved on to Iowa, where Ike found steady work playing country music on live radio. In 1945, little Donnie and baby boy Phil began singing with their parents on air. In the mid-1950s, Don and Phil settled in Nashville and launched themselves as the Everly Brothers. Their breakthrough came in 1957 when they cut Bye Bye Love, a song rejected by 30 other acts, said RollingStone.com. Phil later recalled driving into Nashville and hearing the song playing on pop radio for the first time. "That was like big juju," he said. Nearly three dozen hit singles followed, including All I Have to Do Is Dream in 1958. The brothers' hit-making streak ended in the mid-1960s with the arrival of a raunchier, rockier Beatles and the Rolling Stones, said The Guardian. As they slipped down the charts, drug use and a hard life on the road took its toll. After years of silence following their 1973 split, Don and Phil agreed to play together in London, resulting in The Reunion Concert, their first album to chart in a dozen years. Yet the brothers soon drifted apart again. "Everything is different about us, except when we sing together," Don said in 1999. "I'm a liberal Democrat. He's pretty conservative." The Everly's last high-profile concert together took place a decade ago, when they opened for Simon and Garfunkel. "They hadn't seen each other in about 3 years," Paul Simon recalled. "Yet when they started singing, they were in total harmony." It was still that sound I fell in love with as a kid, said Simon. It was still perfect. Our longer read in the last word section this week is titled The Inside Man. The FBI spent decades searching its ranks for a KGB agent, said David Wise. A hunt, it pretends, never happened. One spring night in 1962, a short, stocky Russian walked into the FBI office in Midtown Manhattan and offered his services as a spy for the United States. Alexei Kulak, then 39, was working undercover as a science official at the United Nations. He said he was unhappy with his progress at his true employer, the KGB. Kulak was taking a huge risk by entering the FBI office. The building was just 3 blocks from the Soviet UN mission, which provided cover for dozens of KGB agents. "Aren't you worried they may be watching the FBI building?" the FBI agent asked. "No," Kulak replied. "All of our people are covering a meeting with your guy, Dick." Your guy, Dick. The Russian was clearly saying that the KGB had a mole inside the FBI. With those 3 words, he set off an earthquake inside the bureau that reverberated for decades and remains unsettled even now. Kulak became the FBI's Bureau Source 10 with the code name Fedora. Behind his back, agents called him Fatso. The FBI assigned the code name Unsub Dick, unsub being the term for unknown subject, to the mole that Kulak said was hidden inside the bureau. Kulak had scarcely left the FBI building that evening before the bureau launched a mole hunt that shook the foundations of the bureau, said David Major, a former FBI counterintelligence agent. Over the course of 3 decades, hundreds of agents' careers fell under the shadow of the investigation. In terms of corrosive effect, Major cites only one comparable event in U.S. intelligence history, the notorious mole hunt James Jesus Angleton conducted within the CIA, which paralyzed the agency's Soviet operations and destroyed or damaged the careers of as many as 50 loyal CIA officers between 1961 and 1974, when Angleton was fired. You know how Angleton ripped apart the agency? Major, who retired from the FBI in 1994, told me. Well, the same thing happened to the Bureau. Dick ripped the Bureau apart, but it never became public. The Bureau's first task was to ensure that it didn't assign the mission of finding Dick to Dick himself. To reduce that risk, the hunt was given to 2 trusted senior counterintelligence agents, Joseph J. Hingenmuhl and Joseph J. Palguta, who were good friends as well as colleagues. Hingenmuhl was a big, burly guy, over 6 feet, brash. Cuss words were every other word, recalls Michael J. Wagspach, another seasoned FBI counter-spy. He was the Soviet program in New York. Palguta had taught himself Russian from Berlitz recordings and was fluent in the language. According to John J. O'Flaherty, another former counterintelligence agent, his accent was convincing enough that he would sometimes pose as a Russian. Armed with little more than a name, and uncertain whether it was the target's real name or a KGB code name, Hingenmuhl and Palguta set out to catch a mole. With 1,000 agents, New York was the FBI's largest field office. There were about 6 or 7 Soviet squads, said an FBI counterintelligence agent assigned to New York at the time. Some were looking at the UN. Some were looking at Americans the Soviets contacted, plus lookout squads and a squad that did surveillance. There were maybe 50 people combined on each squad. So with 6 or 7 squads, there were over 300 agents looking at the Soviets. which means everyone on those squads was a potential suspect, including FBI agents working against Eastern European targets. The number of logical suspects totaled about 500. Of course, everyone named Dick had to be investigated. Dick McCarthy became the first suspect because of his name, says Walter C. Goose Guthiel, or Guthiel, a New York FBI counterintelligence agent. Richard F. McCarthy, who worked on a squad that targeted the GRU, Soviet Military Intelligence, assumed the mole hunters investigated him, but says they never interviewed him. I hope I was a suspect. They had to look at people with the first name, he says. About the only other thing the mole hunters knew was that on the night Kulak walked into the FBI office, he said Dick was out meeting with the KGB. That reassured Kulak that he wasn't talking to the mole, whose identity and appearance he didn't know. And he gave Hingenmuehl and Palguta a clue, however slight. They could try to narrow the field of suspects by determining who was on the street at that hour. You'd want to see who worked that day, based on time cards, when did they sign in, what was on their time card, said former FBI agent Edwin L. Worthington. Although Hingenmuehl and Palguta held their mission closely, word got around as they delved into counterintelligence agents' backgrounds, the cases they handled, and their possible vulnerabilities to recruitment by the KGB. For security reasons, the mole hunters worked from a windowless back room in the New York FBI office, in an area set apart from the rest of the floor. It was supposed to be secret, but everyone knew about the search, Major says. James A. Holt, a counterintelligence agent in New York at the time, says the mole hunt shattered morale. There was consternation in the New York office because everybody knew they were under the gun, that they were being looked at. One reason for the apprehension is that many agents worried that the investigation might uncover other sins that would get them in trouble. A drinking problem, an extramarital affair. An agent who lived through the mole hunt recalled hearing about one guy who used to go to a bar every morning before he reported to work. The investigation seemed to be getting no closer to its target. The mole hunters decided to try something new, a dangle operation, in which they would send an FBI agent posing as a turncoat to offer his services to the KGB, in the hope that any conversations that resulted would elicit some clues to the identity of Unsub Dick. A former FBI agent explained how the dangle worked. A watcher for us, a street agent, walked into the apartment of Boris Ivanov, the KGB resident in New York. Ivanov slammed the door, but not before our agent said he would meet them at such and such a time and place. In fact, a KGB agent showed up at the appointed time and place. We ran the operation for 6 months. There were three or four meetings, the ex-counterintelligence agent says. We hoped their questions might lead us to Dick, the questions they asked and the questions they did not ask, because that would imply they had a source already in those areas. That might give us a clue to the identity of Dick. But the KGB never asked the right questions, said the operation, and the operation proved fruitless. With so many agents to investigate, there seemed to be no end to the mole hunt. It went on for years, a former head of the Soviet section at FBI headquarters says. It drove us crazy. As the investigation persisted, it magnified a question that had arisen the moment Alexei Kulak presented himself to the FBI. Was he a true agent in place for the FBI, or a double agent planted by the KGB? If he was a double agent, could his warning about Unsub Dick be trusted? Some FBI agents argued that Kulak was simply playing mind games with the Bureau, that Dick was a phantom. Like the hunt for Unsub Dick, the argument about Kulak went on for decades. Compounding the mistrust in the New York office and tensions within headquarters. One former counterintelligence agent, an assistant chief of the Soviet section at headquarters, said he periodically changed his mind. I certainly had access and read through the Fedora file. When I retired in 1988, it was 92 volumes, he says. I believe that the information from Fedora was probably good. There were those, myself included, who sometimes question Bureau Source 10's bona fides. Depends on which side of the bed I got up. Others who have doubted that Kulak was working for the United States point out that when he returned to Moscow in 1976, he was not executed, unlike the GRU officer Dmitry Fedorovich Polyakov, who provided valuable information to the CIA and the FBI for 18 years, until the CIA mole Aldrich Ames betrayed him in the 1980s. Kulak survived his homecoming, they note, even though American media reports had hinted that the FBI had a KGB source in New York. In a 1978 book, author Edward J. Epstein went so far as to publish the codename Fedora and describe him as a KGB officer working undercover at the UN and specializing in science and technology. But Kulak was never arrested, and the agency eventually received word that he died of natural causes in the early 1980s. On the question of whether the KGB had a mole in the FBI, Oleg Kalugin, a major general in the KGB, said yes, it did. Kalugin worked in New York undercover for the KGB for 5 years starting in 1958. Kalugin said he actually paid the FBI agent for his services to the KGB, more than once and in person. I paid Dick, but I didn't know his true name, Kalugin says. He did not say how much he paid. The FBI paid Kulak $100,000 over 15 years, but he may have had more than money on his mind. One agent says Kulak was worried that Unsub Dick would find out that he was spying for the FBI and tell the KGB about him. That's why he dimed him out, the FBI man said. Kulak, he said, kept telling the Bureau to find him. Over time, the mole hunt faded. In the mid-1980s, however, an FBI analyst named Robert H. King concluded that he had identified Unsub Dick. Through Kulak, he learned both that the KGB had a source who had retired from the FBI and lived in Queens, New York, and the initial of the source's last name. He checked the name of every FBI agent who lived in Queens in the 1960s and found a match when the initial was translated from Cyrillic to English. The agent had a host of problems, including alcohol abuse, which could have made him a target for recruitment by the KGB. He had retired young on a medical disability around 1964. An FBI agent was sent to interview the suspect. He denied he was a spy. In 1973, Kalugin was in Moscow, serving as chief of KGB Worldwide Counterintelligence. There was one file on our man in the FBI, Kalugin told me. He was retired and living in Queens. That man, he said, was the mole Kulak had warned about, the one the FBI had dubbed Unsub Dick. To this day, the FBI is maintaining its silence on Unsub Dick. In response to several requests for comment, a spokesman said none would be forthcoming and that the Assistant Director for Counterintelligence will not confirm or deny such a case. This was copyrighted in 2013 by David Wise. It was taken from a longer article originally published in Smithsonian Magazine. Here are a couple of pieces from our Health and Science page. Mapping human emotions. When you're angry, your face, head, and arms grow hot. When you're depressed, a cold numbness grips your head and arms. Love triggers a warm glow throughout your upper body, especially around your heart. Human emotions, a new study has found, are directly linked to sensations in specific body parts, and the map is largely the same across different cultures. Finnish researchers reached that conclusion after showing 700 study participants in Finland, Sweden, and Taiwan words, videos, facial expressions, and stories designed to evoke 13 emotions such as happiness, sadness, shame, disgust, envy, anxiety, and love. For each emotion, participants indicated where they felt increased and decreased sensation on computer-generated silhouettes of the human body. Individuals of different cultures and linguistic backgrounds drew very similar maps, indicating that emotions are hardwired to prepare the body for fighting, hugging, withdrawing, and other behaviors. Our emotional system in the brain sends signals to the body so we can deal with our situation. Aalto University psychologist Lauri Nieminen tells NPR.org, "It's an automated system. We don't have to think about it. The information about how the body and feelings interact may help in diagnosing and even treating some emotional disorders." Foraging by instinct. The way people walk when shopping or exploring a new place may be rooted in a hunting instinct they share with animals from penguins and sharks to honeybees. A new study has found that the Hadza, a Tanzanian tribe of hunter-gatherers, follow a mathematical pattern of movement called the Levy walk when looking for food. The pattern, named after French mathematician Paul Levy, involves many short exploratory moves within a small area, then a longer trek to another location, followed by additional short-distance inspections. Detecting this pattern among the Hadza, as has been found in several other species, tells us that such patterns are likely the result of general foraging strategies that many species adopt across a wide variety of contexts. Yale University anthropologist Brian Wood tells ScienceDaily.com, "Previous studies have shown that people take a Levy walk when wandering university campuses, urban environments, and amusement parks. But it was unknown whether the movement was natural or a response to the way things are built. Its use by hunter-gatherers suggests it is a fundamental pattern connecting human evolutionary history with that of other species." On the Talking Points page, marijuana, now fully legal in Colorado. "Back in the 1970s, I smoked the occasional joint," said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. "So call me a hypocrite, but I'm not one of the millions of marijuana enthusiasts celebrating Colorado's full legalization of weed on January 1st. Soon, Washington State will follow suit. Voters in Alaska, Oregon, and California will consider fully legalizing pot this year. Advocates for legal weed argue that alcohol causes far more social problems, but the fact remains that the American Medical Association recently deemed cannabis a dangerous drug, citing research that weed often leads to abuse of other recreational drugs and permanently lowers IQ in teens who smoke it regularly. We've all known stoners who've lost their drive and self-control," said David Brooks in the New York Times. "So why give marijuana the official stamp of government approval? In healthy societies, government discourages lesser pleasures, like being stoned. Healthy societies don't throw millions of people in human meat lockers to satisfy the moral urges of social engineers," said Matt Welch in Reason.com. "There are about 750,000 marijuana arrests every year, nearly half of all drug arrests. The cost to society of trying to police marijuana use and to individuals who get jailed for it are both wildly out of proportion. Then there's the racial discrimination issue, said Jamel Bowie in thedailybeast.com. Blacks in the U.S. use and sell cannabis at the same rate as whites, but are four times more likely to be arrested for it. For middle-class white teenagers like Ruth Marcus and David Brooks once were, smoking pot was a rite of passage with little risk. You can't say the same for black teenagers. When cops search them on the street and find marijuana, they are deemed criminals, and their entire lives can be changed for the worse. My recreational drugs of choice are alcohol and caffeine, not marijuana, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. But Colorado citizens have every right to legalize weed. Over time, legalization may prove to be a mistake, or it may not. Either way, it's an experiment worth conducting. But that doesn't mean every state has an obligation to legalize marijuana or any other individual liberty over citizens' objections. The beauty of our system is, or should be, that every state can adopt standards the majority of its citizens want. If Colorado wants to legalize weed, fine. If Alabama doesn't, that's fine too. Obama. Is a comeback in 2014 possible? Call me crazy, but 2014 could be President Obama's best year, said Dean Obadiah in thedailybeast.com. True, he has much to overcome. Badly wounded by the botched Obamacare launch, Obama has seen his disapproval ratings rise to 54%, his worst ever. But the president has a lot to be optimistic about. The economic recovery shows every sign of picking up speed. The unemployment rate at 7% is at its lowest during his administration, and GDP growth is surprisingly strong. Obama will soon launch a new offensive on both immigration reform and an increase in the minimum wage, both of which have broad public support. Meanwhile, Obamacare's technical problems are over, and as Americans see evidence it's making people's lives better, public support for the program and the president will rise. Combine that with a badly splintered Republican Party that is offering nothing but stubborn opposition, and 2014 could be a comeback year for the president. You've got to be kidding, said Neil Monroe in DailyCaller.com. Obama enters the new year with his credibility fatally damaged by Obamacare, which will continue to hurt more Americans than it will help. His campaign against economic inequality is nothing but hot air, and his foreign policy doesn't bear mentioning, since he was roundly outplayed on Syria by Russian President Vladimir Putin and duped into a flawed Iran nuclear deal. Better still, Obamacare has legs, said Fred Barnes in WeeklyStandard.com. In 2014, millions will discover that their premiums have increased and their favorite doctors are no longer covered. Problems bound to increase Obama's unpopularity and give Republicans control of the Senate and the House after the midterm elections. Liberals need to face the facts. Obama's prospects for recovery are poor. In politics, though, the pendulum almost always swings back, said Jeff Schessel in NewYorker.com. Obama is beginning to show a clarity of purpose that was too often lacking during his first term, and plans to take the fight to Republicans on immigration, food stamps, and economic fairness. Republicans will probably take the bait, said Doyle McManus in LATimes.com, producing another high-decibel collision, not bipartisan harmony. More gridlock will only create deeper public disgust with both parties. Still, at least Obama has one bittersweet asset on his side. Expectations for 2014 are low. Only in America A Florida man with a moral opposition to trimming the plants, grass, and weeds in his yard has racked up over $130,000 in fines. Neighbors complain that Sean Law's unkempt lawn is an eyesore that's driving down property values. But Law says it's his right to grow crops on his property in a natural manner, and calls it a blunt tyranny for the government to interfere. It was a good week for defying your parents after 12-year-old Jackson Wood of Kentucky stayed up to 3 a.m. playing computer games and smelled an electrical fire in the kitchen. He woke his family and got all 9 people to evacuate, thus saving their lives. It was a good week for democracy after a Tennessee man whose pet raccoon, Rebecca, was confiscated by state wildlife authorities announced he was running for governor so he could get his furry friend back. "This is all about the raccoon," said Mark Coon Rippy Brown. It was a bad week for playing hide-and-seek after an Australian man hid naked inside a top-loading washing machine to surprise his girlfriend and had to be freed by police, who used olive oil as a lubricant. It was a bad week for the nuns of Lucina after Pope Francis rang the Spanish convent to wish the sisters a happy new year, but left a voice message when no one picked up. What are the nuns doing that they can't answer? The pontiff joked in his message. I am Pope Francis. And finally, a quote from Lindsay Lohan. How come when Kanye acts like an idiot, he gets a gold record? But when I act like an idiot, I get a police record. Something to think about. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.